When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name. Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or else media.
Imagine that it's the Hyborian Age, and you are a Turanian merchant in Agrippur, the capital of Turin, where your king Yildiz rules. The sun is shining, the market is bustling, and you're up to your usual morning routine, watching the world pass by while pretending to haggle over a crate of figs. And that is when you spot him. Tall, broad-shouldered, and wearing a white fur cape that looks like he skinned a snow bear in his spare time. A barbarian, no doubt, sword at his side, scowl on his face. He looks about as approachable as a rabid wolf. Now, Agrippur sees plenty of strangers, but this one, this guy is extra. You can tell by the way folks are whispering around him. He's a Vannerman. They eat babies raw, I've heard. No! He's from Asgard, for sure. These people can't agree on anything. You almost want to step in and educate them because you know better. He's Sumerian, has to be. You recognize the look, that icy stare that says he's more interested in your gold than your life story. Naturally, you start following him because who wouldn't want to see how this plays out? You blend in with the crowd, weaving between merchants hawking their wares while keeping an eye on the barbarian. He's clearly taking it all in. Canopied litters, veiled princesses, merchants arguing over prices, and let's not forget the, professional ladies of the street. You swear that you catch him smirking at one point. Maybe the city is growing on him. Suddenly, a chorus of wailing hits the air, and you almost drop the dates you're pretending to care about. You spin around, and what do you see? A pack of topless women dancing and shrieking like they've been possessed by something stronger than cheap wine. It's like a religious parade crossed with a bad dream. You spot a litter behind them, and in it, a statue of the living Tareem, the statue, the wooden image of your one true god that's missing an arm. Aye, it's the one-armed image of the Tareem! The living Tareem is back in his temple! Apparently this is big news. Then the barbarian, clearly unimpressed, grunts.
So that's what all the noise is about. A wooden doll?
You almost wince at the barbarian's bold choice of words. And before you can say oops, a wine merchant nearby loses his freaking mind.
Blasphemer! This man mocks our god!
You shake your head. This is not gonna end well. The barbarian, however, does try to explain.
I didn't say anything about your god.
But the crowd is already riled up, and nobody's listening. A mob forms faster than you can slip behind a stack of melons. A group of men charge in, shouting,
"Slay the blasphemer! Slay him!"
And suddenly, they pile atop the barbarian, fists flying. At this point, you're thinking, well, that's the end of that. But no, the barbarian grunts, flexes, and suddenly throws five grown men off of him like they were sacks of grain. It's both terrifying and kind of impressive. It's at that point, of course, that the swords come out. At first, it seems that the barbarian might have a chance of winning. Wielding his own scimitar, he drops people one after another, like baskets of rotting fruit. That's when a mounted warrior rides up, scimitar raised, ready to slice the barbarian in two. You start to back up, looking for cover. The barbarian, though, he's having none of it. He charges the horse, shoving his shoulder into the beast's belly, and down it goes, crushing the rider underneath with a sickening crunch. You cringe back, wincing. That guy is not getting up again. For a moment, the crowd goes silent, clearly shocked by what they just witnessed. You start to think, all right, maybe that's enough for today. But no, of course it's not. A priest, veins practically bulging out of his forehead.
Are you men or base-born jackals? The defiler must be slain!
And just like that, The mob surges in again, pushing the barbarian back into the closed door of a nearby building. It looks like he's about to make his last stand right there. You're smart. You take a step back and find the nearest stall to duck behind. This isn't your fight after all, but you can't deny you're staying to watch. Because this, right here, this is by far the best thing that you have ever seen in the marketplace. From Stephen R. Else Media, this is Hither Came Conan and our deep dive into Conan the Barbarian number 29 from Marvel Comics. Welcome to Hither Came Conan, the podcast of swords, sorcery, and a half-naked barbarian with the steeliest of thews. I'm your host, my name is Steven, and while my thews aren't as steely as Conan's, they are quite weak and feeble. I'm not proud of it, but I mean, they are what they are, and what they are would be more comparable to silly putty than steel. Or, I don't know, maybe a nice thick jelly. You know what? I tend to mention Conan's steely thews quite often on the show, don't I? Do you think maybe that I might be a bit jealous, you know, of Conan and his sculpted body of power? I don't know. Seems kind of dumb, don't it? I mean, he's not a real person, right? He's the product of a writer's imagination. So yeah, I guess it would be a bit silly for me to feel any sort of envy toward the fella's fictitious form. And yet, look, it doesn't matter.
Mind your own business.
We're not here to talk about my body issues. I mean, there just aren't that many hours in a day. So instead, how about we take a swim in today's issue, Conan the Barbarian, number 29. This issue sports a cover date of August 1973, though it hit the stands in May. It sold for just 20 cents, and it is entitled Two Against Turin. It was written by Roy Thomas, with pencils by John Buscema, inks by Ernie Chan. The letters were by John Costanza, and Glennis Ween was the colorist.
Into the boat!
Our story begins with Conan striding confidently into the Turanian capital of Agrippur. Now, this is the city that is home to King Yildiz, who happens to be the father of Prince Yezdegerd, who's currently off somewhere in the east, dreaming of caving Conan's head in with a big stick. Conan arrives in town in time to see the delivery of the statue of Tarim, and being the sensitive Sumerian we all know him to be, he talks shit on the Turanian god. He's not quiet about it either, and it's not long before he offends most everyone on the street around him.
Think before you talk shit.
Soon he is attacked by sword-swinging zealots, and though Conan gives as good as he gets, he is quickly overwhelmed by the sheer number of armed attackers, and he is forced to flee for his life. The zealots give chase, but before they can catch the Sumerian, he is rescued by a stranger who leads Conan through the back alleys to the safety of a tavern.
How's that for a slice of fried gold?
As they take a seat and begin drinking, the man introduces himself as Ormraxes, and yet, when a group of armed guards arrive to arrest the man, they call him Ithriel. Conan tries to help his new friend, and a fight breaks out. More and more guards pour into the tavern, and it's not long before Conan is overwhelmed and knocked unconscious. He's later revived by a masked man who informs Conan where Ormraxes is being held. Conan, determined to repay his debt to Ormraxes, sneaks into the dungeon, works his way through the guards, and rescues Ormraxes from the forces of King Yildiz.
It's a stupid, stupid non-name.
Upon his return, Conan discovers that the masked man is, in fact, the real Ithriel, a powerful wizard. And Ormraxes is actually his spiritual projection that Ithriel was using as a spy.
You're right, I have a horrible, horrible name.
The man and the spirit use a crystal and begin the mystical process of reuniting themselves with each other. As the magic is happening, Conan learns from Ithriel's lackeys that the wizard, once complete, will become super powerful and will use that power to ravage all of Turin. It's then that Conan realizes that he's currently standing in Turin, and knowing that he too will be destroyed when the wizard lets loose, interrupts the ceremony with his sword, and Ethereal, along with his spiritual twin, bursts into flames.
You burnt!
A contingent of Turanian soldiers appear and reveal that they know what has happened. Basically. They then offer Conan a choice. He can either enlist in the Turanian army or face imprisonment. And so, as the issue ends, Conan chooses to join the army.
The army?
Yeah, the army.
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages. And now, back to Hither Came Conan.
Alright, so the story in this issue is based on Two Against Tyr, a historical adventure story from Robert E. Howard. It's not a Conan story, but as we know, Howard didn't pigeonhole himself by only writing fantasy stories about a big guy with muscles, a sword, and the endless ability to solve all the problems in the world by stabbing them. Oh no, folks! Big Bobby Howard dabbled in all sorts of stories, from horror to westerns to good old historical fiction. And that brings us to Two Against Tyr. Now, I can hear you over there on the other end of this RSS feed as you're riding your stationary bike or washing dishes or preparing yourself physically and mentally for the as-yet unannounced first manned mission to Mars. And I can hear you asking yourself, just what the heck is this Two Against Tyr story all about? Well, that's why I'm here, folks, to fill in those empty cracks with the putty of knowledge. Of course, I have to admit that I've never actually read the story, not having access to it without dropping at least $15. But here's what I've pieced together thanks to a little place that I like to call the internets.
What the fuck is the internet?
Tyr, by the way, in case you're wondering, it's spelled T-Y-R-E. Anyway, Two Against Tyr is set in the ancient Phoenician city of Tyr, a place that is basically the Costco of the ancient world, meaning that when people needed shit, they went to Tyr. Like, picture bustling markets, shouting merchants, and maybe even a few ancient Phoenicians trying to return some sketchy olive oil they bought in bulk. Howard transports us to this city at its peak, a thriving, glittering metropolis, and the setting for our story's hero, Ethereal the Gaul. Yeah, I know that Ethereal sounds a little silly, but trust me, he's a serious dude. Ethereal is your classic Howard protagonist. Tough, no nonsense, and he probably spends most of his time shirtless.
Oh my God, put on a shirt.
He's also, if you have yet to deduce from the name Ethereal the Gaul, a Gaul, which, if you're unfamiliar, was the ancient equivalent of saying, I'm from that part of Europe where we still solve disagreements with headbutts and axes. Now, if you'll allow me to vomit out some historical and geographical facts at you, you know, just a bit. Gaul was this huge region that included present-day France, Belgium, Luxembourg, parts of Switzerland, Germany, and bits of Italy. It was about 494,000 square kilometers, which in non-metric terms translates roughly to a crapload of land. And according to Julius Caesar,
Bene, vidi, vici.
Yeah, that guy. Gaul was split into three parts. Gallia Celtica, Belgica, and Aquitania, which sounds less like regions and more like flavors of artisanal cheese. But the Gauls were basically the original don't mess with us crew. See, back in 387 BC, a Gaul named Brennus led his buddies on a field trip to Rome, and oops, they accidentally sacked the city. It was the only time Rome got conquered by outsiders in 800 years. So yeah, it made an impression. Of course, the Romans eventually got their revenge because, well, by the time Julius Caesar came around, he had subdued the majority of Gaul. But even though the Romans eventually brought them into the fold and created this whole Gallo-Roman mashup culture, you know that those Gauls were still the kind of people that would totally go for a casual axe-throwing contest on any given Saturday.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system, and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
So yeah, you don't name a guy Ethereal the Gaul unless he's about to wreck somebody's day. Anyway, he's in the city of Tyr for adventure, intrigue, and probably a lot of violence, because Well, it wouldn't be a Robert E. Howard story without a few skulls getting cracked.
The next time I have to come in here, I'm cracking skulls.
Now, the story is set during the reign of one of the five Assyrian kings named Shalmaneser. And yeah, five. That's what I said. Five kings. All named Shalmaneser.
Horrible name.
Howard's talent for historical fiction shines through here, I guess. I mean, again, I didn't read it, but from what I can gather, Bob manages to take these massive historical figures, put them into a story, and make it seem like Ethereal's about to burst in and say,
"All right, enough with the empire building. Let's settle this the old-fashioned way, with swords, or, you know, by me dramatically flipping over a table in your throne room."
But here's the thing. Two Against Tyre by Robert E. Howard was actually an unfinished draft. I mean, he had a bunch of those, and I can almost imagine Big Bob typing away at his manual typewriter halfway through a fight scene and suddenly going,
"You know what? I think I'll finish this tomorrow."
But plot twist, folks.
Tomorrow never came.
Too soon? Doesn't matter, because fortunately for us, there was this guy named Glenn Lord. He was like the Indiana Jones of Robert E. Howard manuscripts, and he dedicated his life to collecting and preserving Howard's work. In fact, why don't we talk a bit about big old Glenn here for a bit? Because if there was ever a superhero for Robert E. Howard's legacy, it was this guy.
He's a righteous dude.
Glenn Lord was born on November 17th, 1931 in Pelican, Louisiana. And while he lived a regular life in the single most popular career dreamed about by little kids all over the world, he was a paper warehouse manager. He was also a Korean War veteran who happened to stumble upon Howard's work in 1951 in a collection of Big Bob's stories called Skull Face and Others, which was published by Arkham House in 1946. That is when Glenn's journey to the dark side began.
"Strike me down with all of your hatred, and your journey towards the dark side will be complete."
I'm sorry, did I say dark side? I meant to say that the reading of Skull Face and Others is where Glenn's journey into Bob Howard fandom began. What started as a hobby, you know, just trying to track down Howard's work, quickly escalated into what can only be described as a full-blown treasure hunt. Glorious Glenn scoured the country, hunting down everything Robert E. Howard ever put to paper. And when I say everything, I mean the man built the single largest collection of Howard's stories, poems, and letters in existence. Like I said, the guy was basically Indiana Jones, but instead of ancient artifacts, he was after pulp magazines and manuscripts. And then in 1965, Big Glenn hit the frickin' jackpot. He had managed to track down Robert E. Howard's legendary storage trunk, which, as it happens, was filled with tens of thousands of typed pages, many of them unpublished. It must have been like cracking open a literary tomb. I mean, can you imagine what that must have felt like for old Glenn when he popped open that trunk and realized that he was standing in front of the ultimate hoard of Robert E. Howard material? Well, from that point on, Lord became the guy, the man responsible for getting Howard's work back into the world. He was, after all, the literary agent for the Howard estate for almost three decades. And during that time, he made sure that if there was a book publisher, magazine, fanzine, or even a comic book that wanted to print Howard's work, they got it. He was like Oprah, but for Robert E. Howard stories. "You get a Howard story, you get a Howard story, everybody gets a Howard story!" Sorry. I will never do that again, folks. Sorry. Anyway, thanks to Lord's tireless efforts, the 1970s saw a full-blown Howard renaissance. Howard's tales, once hidden away in dusty old trunks and forgotten pulp magazines, were suddenly everywhere. In fact, whenever Roy Thomas had an issue of Conan the Barbarian to write, an issue in which he wanted to tell a certain type of Conan story or put Conan into certain situations that would eventually lead him to an issue that would, you know, tell an actual Bob Howard Conan tale, and Roy knew that there was a non-Conan Howard story in existence that he could twist and bend to his will in order to tell his Conan tale, well, Roy just had to reach out to Glenn. That's how we get Two Against Turin and Moon of Zimbabwe and The Blood of Belhisar and many, many more. I think it's safe to say, folks, that While I place the reason for Conan's ultimate worldwide popularity squarely upon the shoulders of Roy Thomas, because after all, I don't think you would ever have had the movies without the comics, I would be remiss if I didn't add that you wouldn't have the comics without Glenn Lord, giving Roy the access to much of the Robert E. Howard library. In other words, Glenn Lord was one important dude.
Thank you, Glenn.
Anyway, that's a little bit of the backstory behind the issue, Conan the Barbarian number 29, and the story contained therein, Two Against Turin. With that, how about we dive into this four-color Conan adventure just a bit deeper? We will start, as always, with the cover. This was penciled by Gil Kane and inked by Ernie Chan. In fact, while to this point, Gil had given us covers to Conan the Barbarian issues 12, 17, 18, 23, and 25, he actually became kind of the Conan cover guy, beginning with issue number 27, The Blood of Belhisar. He would go on to do over 50 Conan covers during Conan's first reign at Marvel, freeing up John Buscema to just, you know, tackle them interiors.
You got way too much free time, man.
The cover, fairly standard fare for a Conan comic. We have a wizard in a hooded mask standing atop a staircase, an arch over top him, and he's holding some kind of crystal in his hand, and there's basically freaking laser beams shooting out of the crystal, shooting at Conan. Flames are erupting everywhere. There's dead people all over. Conan's got blood and flames on his sword. And of course, there is a half-naked babe cringing behind Conan, because that's what Conan does. You know, he protects half-naked babes. And in fact, when you actually read the issue, you'll figure out real quick that there's no half-naked babes in the story at all. There's no female character that Conan is, you know, trying to protect. There's no supporting female character at all. And yet we get one here on the cover. And Roy points out in his book, Barbarian Life, A Literary Biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1, he points out that, you know, they kind of had to put a half-naked babe on all the covers. Because that, again, that's what Conan was all about. And Roy eventually just kind of gave that character, that female character that doesn't always show up in the story, he named her Mirage, M-I-R-A-A-J, as if she was a mirage. Pretty interesting, Roy.
It really was.
Anyway, getting into the issue, we open with Conan striding the stairs, coming up from the port outside. You know, they're at Agrippur, because Agrippur is on the coast of the Viliet Sea. It is the capital of Turin, which seems kind of weird for Conan, considering that this is where Prince Yezdegerd comes from. This is where he lives. This is the guy that wants to kill Conan because Conan cut up his face in an issue. Far, far back. I don't remember which issue it was, but...
Hello. I'm your friendly fake text-to-speech informational voice, and I'm here to tell you that the issue Stephen is trying to reference is Conan the Barbarian issue number 20, The Black Hound of Vengeance, published by Marvel Comics on August the 15th, 1972. Thank you.
Yezdegerd doesn't like Conan. He wants his head on a spike, and yet Conan is just walking into Turin with a big white fur cape on his back and no shirt, and he's like, yeah, do something. Because Conan, you know, Conan don't give a shit. But it's kind of funny because as he's walking into Agrippur, there's all these people around him that are whispering. They know he's not a Hyrcanian. They know he's not from Turin. They know he's not from this area. They can tell he's from the north. Some folks think that he is a Vanerman. Some folks think that he's from Asgard. And others think that he might be a Hyperborean. But nobody points out that he just might be a Sumerian. And it makes me wonder, do the Turanians know about Sumeria? Is that kind of a far-off mythical place that they think maybe isn't real? I don't know. But Conan starts wandering through the city, hands on hips like he's freaking Superman or something. He strikes a pose at one point as a, I don't know if she's a prostitute, being carried through the streets on like some kind of dais, some kind of bed. Like a portable bed. But he's standing there staring at her with his hands on his hips like he's freaking sexy Superman. You know, as if Superman, if he was the type of guy to go, hey, hey, check out that prostitute. She's pretty hot. That's what Superman would be doing if Superman was like that. But Superman's not like that. Conan is.
Anyway, as he's walking through the streets, these women who literally, when I say half naked, they are half naked. They have no tops on, but we can't see their boobies.
Boobies?
Because they're all drawn in such a way that their hair just conveniently falls over their boobies.
Boobies.
But they're dancing. There's like six or seven of them. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight of them that I can make out. They're dancing and they're screaming about the Tareem. The Tareem lives. Tareem, Tareem. We are all bathed in the blood of the Tareem. They're just freaking going crazy. And Conan, of course, stops and gives pause. He's like, what the flip is happening here? Did the Tareem actually show up? Because Conan knows that's not possible. He knows that the Tareem is dead because Conan was there when the guy died.
This event happened in Conan the Barbarian issue number 26. Published by Marvel Comics on February the 20th, 1973.
But Conan realizes that it's not the Tareem that's being paraded through the streets. It's that wooden statue of the Tareem with just one arm that Conan first saw in the, good Lord, what was it, issue 19? I don't remember. It was back a ways.
Conan the Barbarian number 19 from July 18th, 1972.
It was the official start of the whole War of the Tareem story arc. And Conan, realizing that it's just this little wooden statue, says out loud,
so that's what all the shouting was about. Prince Yezdegerd sends home that wooden doll of his while he sets fire to the east. And these fools stand around bellowing like branded bulls.
And again, he says it out loud. There's an exclamation point at the end of the sentence, so that makes you think that not only did he say it out loud, he said it really loud, and all the people on the streets hear him, and they're pretty upset because this is their god that Conan is mocking. And soon swords are drawn, and people are coming out of nowhere, and they're attacking Conan. Conan draws his own sword, and there's one panel here where he makes a big slashing movement with his sword, and he cuts down one, two, three, four people at the same time. It's pretty cool. I mean, if you like that sort of thing, but, you know, at first, basically, they all just kind of jump on Conan.
There he is. There's the blasphemer. Let's kick his ass.
And they all just dogpile on him while he's, you know,
Crom's devils,
he says. And he just ends up throwing them all off of him. There's a good six or seven guys on top of him, beating him, pulling him to the ground. Conan's on his back, and yet he still manages to get up and toss these people off of him. And that's when the swords come out and Conan just starts killing some people.
He's on the jazz, man.
He even, at one point, a guy on a horse comes after Conan and the horse rears up on its hind legs and Conan ducks under the horse, grabs it around the stomach and pulls the horse to the ground. Actually, flips the horse over so that when the horse hits the ground, the horse lands on his back. The rider is still on the horse's back and he crushes the dude into the street under the horse.
Wow, that was kind of brutal.
Conan is not only killing a bunch of people, he's doing it in some very unique and interesting ways, at least in this one scene he is. But more and more people join the fight to kill the, you know, the blasphemer. And Conan realizes that he's probably going to die. He's going to take out probably about 30 or 40 of them while this happens, but he's probably going to die. And it's then that he's rescued by this guy who pulls him into this room and they sneak out the back and they sneak through the back alleyways until eventually they wind up at a tavern. But they do so and they happen to avoid the angry, bloodthirsty mob in the process. The guy introduces himself to Conan as Ormraxes of Iranistan, and he tells Conan that he helped him because he needs Conan's help. He doesn't like to see unfair things. You know, he figured that was kind of an unfair fight. Conan against an entire city.
You're Conan. You're the destroyer.
So that's partly why he did it, but mostly because he needs Conan's help. Conan, however, doesn't find out what kind of help this guy needs because these guards rush into the freaking tavern. They're looking for Ormraxes, though they call him Ethereal, which if you paid attention during my bit there earlier about Two Against Tyre, that was the name of that character, Ethereal the Gaul. Anyway, the guards go to take this guy away. Conan tries to intervene. They start fighting. He kills some more people.
Quit killing people. That's high profile.
Oh, lighten up.
But then one of the guards smacks Conan on the back of the head with a mace, and Conan falls to the ground, blood trickling out of his forehead, and everything for Conan goes black.
Ooh, they're gonna feel that in the morning.
Conan wakes sometime later. He's in a different room, and he's being tended to by a guy in a turban. Conan immediately goes for the guy's throat because he thinks that the guy's getting ready to torture Conan. He finds instead, however, that this guy works for this dude in this hooded mask who won't explain to Conan why he's wearing a mask. He just tells him that he'll learn that in time.
Mind your own business!
But he gives Conan some food, he gives Conan some drink, and they sit down to talk. And the masked man points out that he thinks that Conan is the kind of guy who repays his debts.
You, sir, having a life play with this and his?
He figures that Ormraxi saved Conan's life, and so Conan owes him big time, basically. And he tells Conan that Ormraxi is in the dungeon at the palace, at, you know, where King Yildiz hangs. And he tells him that one of his boys can show Conan how to get into the dungeon, and Conan agrees to rescue Ormraxi and bring him back to the masked man. So Conan breaks into the dungeon, and it's here we meet like these prison guards, and they're all playing dice, and they're just being, you know, hugely muscled, lazy guards. Conan has to fight his way through all of them, but eventually he takes them all down. The last guy, who's this big, giant, bald dude with a beard and a double-bladed axe, he and this guy start fighting, and the way Conan takes him out is he literally, the guy takes a swing at Conan with the axe, Conan grabs his wrist in one hand, puts his other hand underneath the guy's chin, flips him over, and slams his head into the brick floor, cracking his head open and killing him.
It's totally brutal.
But eventually he finds Ormraxi. He frees him. He takes him back to the masked man. And this is when he learns that the masked man is Ithriol, a powerful wizard, and Ormraxi is basically his double. It's his spiritual reflection that he sent out just to kind of get the lay of the land, to spy on King Yildiz and just see what's what. And while the two of them are separated, Ithriol is not as powerful a wizard as he once was. They've been separated for quite a time. I don't know if they actually say how long they've been separated. Let me look.
What's taking so long?
I don't know. If they do, I'm not seeing it upon my scan. But we do know that because it's nighttime at this point, but they have been separated long enough that if he doesn't recombine with his spiritual self before the sun comes up, they will never be combined together again, and they will both die. And so they pull out Ithriel pulls out a crystal, and the two of them, him and his spiritual self, get to work doing the spell or whatever that's going to bring them back together. And while they're doing that, one of the lackeys of, well, actually both of the lackeys, they pull swords on Conan to keep him back. They don't want him to do anything to stop this process. And then for some stupid reason, because I really doubt at this point Conan was thinking, well, that's not good, I got to put a stop to this. I think Conan was just going to sit there and let it happen.
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages. And now back to Hither Came Conan.
But these guys pull out their swords, threatening to kill him if he tries to intervene. And then for some stupid reason, explain to Conan that while Ithriol was separated from his spiritual self, he learned a lot about magic from ancient scrolls and whatnot. And once they become one again, he's going to be even more powerful than he was in the first place, and he's just going to start kicking all kinds of ass. He's going to burn Turin to the ground, and you know, he may not stop there. And that's when Conan realizes that if he wants to live, he's going to have to put a stop to it. And he does so simply by tossing his sword between the two, you know, Ethereal and his spirit double, and the sword knocks the crystal out of both of their hands. The crystal hits the ground. The sun comes up at that point, shining through the window, and both of them burst into flames. they're dead. All right. They're nothing but a pile of ash. And Conan is standing there looking strong and brooding, looking at this burning pile of ash. He had to kill the other two guys first. So basically, Conan's the only one left alive in this room. And that's when Turanian guards burst in. They kind of tell Conan, yeah, we knew what was going on. We were standing outside. We knew what was happening. We thought you could take care of it. We just let you do all the work. And now that you're done, we're here to take you. And Conan's like, you ain't taking me nowhere, Jack. And the guy's like, whoa, calm down there, Cimmerian. We don't have to take you to prison. How about instead you join the army? And Conan's like, all right, I can do that. Besides, I'm kind of hungry. And so that's how the issue ends. This, I really enjoyed this one. These issues are getting really kind of fun as long as you don't take them too seriously. Plus, again, like I said, there's two different times he kills people in this comic that were actually quite creative. The first one is when he basically throws a horse on top of a guy. And then the other one, well, not as creative. It's more creative than just stabbing people with swords. And that's when he bashes the guy's head into the flagstones of the dungeon floor, which is pretty brutal.
Totally brutal.
The art is still coming along quite nicely. The combination of John Buscema and Ernie Chan it's nice. It looks good. I enjoy it. It still somewhat looks like John Buscema. You know, you can tell that it's John Buscema pencils, but I think I mentioned before that when I really first started to get into comics, one of the books that I read was The Avengers, back when John Buscema was penciling with Tom Palmer on inks. So when I think of John Buscema, that's the look that I think of. And it's very similar here, but Ernie Chan is obviously a different kind of inker than Tom Palmer. He brings a little something different than Palmer does. And I can't quite touch on what that is, but it's different enough that you know that this is, you know, it's still John Buscema, but it's different enough that you can look at this and you can look at the Avengers and know that they're both John Buscema, but they both have different inkers.
That came out a bit glib, didn't it?
I still, with this issue, I still kind of scratch my head over the fact that, you know, why is Conan sticking around in Turin? You know, he's heading west. He's still going in that direction. I'm assuming that this was just kind of a stop off, you know, he's like just, there's a town, you know, on his way. And so he's come to drink some wine and maybe bed a prostitute and maybe have a good night's sleep. And then he'll head back out on the road, but winds up, of course, enlisting in the Turanian army, which just seems silly considering that the Prince of Turin wants to stick his head on a spike. But the whole purpose here is to lead into the story, The Hand of Nergal, which is what we're going to get to next, which is a Conan story, but it's not a Robert E. Howard Conan story. I think it was started by Robert E. Howard and then finished by Lynn Carter, but we'll get into all that next time. But I don't know. It seems that Roy knew that he was going to, adapt The Hand of Nergal, but for him to, I don't know. Maybe the whole purpose here is to kind of point out how much of a badass Conan really is. He knows that the prince, you know, wants to kill him and that he's in the capital where the prince would normally be living, though the prince is out killing Hyrcanians and, you know, the prince could come back at any moment, but Conan just doesn't give a shit. I guess that's just the way Conan is. He's probably came upon Agrippur and he's like, yeah, there's a town. I should probably go there and get something to drink and get me a prostitute and hang out for a couple of days and I'll be back heading west going to Argos. But I don't know. That's where old Prince Yezdegerd, that's where his home is. That's where his dad lives. That guy wants to kill me. But you know what? I don't give a shit.
I don't give a fuck.
He can do what he's going to do. I'm going to go get me some freaking wine. You know, that's who Conan is. I guess that kind of defines one of his defining characteristics. I don't know.
You're an idiot.
Anyway, it was good. I enjoyed it. I had fun. And I'm looking forward to moving on to the next adventure. But yeah, until then, folks, that's all I have to say about Conan the Barbarian, number 29, Two Against Turin. What about you? Is there anything you would like to add? Let me know. Feedback at hithercameconan.com.
Everybody out!
Next time on Hither Came Conan, our titular tough guy faces off against a cursed ruler wielding the darkest of magic, with only an ancient amulet and a half-naked babe standing between him and certain doom. It's all that and more as we get into Conan the Barbarian number 30, The Hand of Nergal. This was published by Marvel Comics in June of 1973. The synopsis used in this episode was taken from MarvelFandom.com and then altered, twisted, rewritten, and added to by me, the host of Hither Came Conan. Hi, how y'all doing? The information used in this episode comes from Wikipedia, from Mike's Amazing World of Comics at mikesamazingworld.com, and the book Barbarian Life, A Literary Biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1 by Roy Thomas, which you can get now at sumerianpress.com. And finally, the views and opinions expressed within this episode are mine and mine alone, and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Howard Estate, Conan, his sword, his steely thews, his many fans and supporters, and especially his god, Crom.
Crom laughs at your four winds.
But before I let you go, folks, a quick update on the colossally cool Hither Came Conan question contest. We've had to push back our viewing of Conan the Destroyer until later in October, so I'm pushing back the deadline for you to get those questions in. You now have until Monday, October the 7th at 11:59 p.m. Central Standard Time. And possibly maybe the week after that. I'll let you know. For more information about the contest and rules, check out the contest link over at hithercameconan.com. So yeah, until next time, folks, keep your swords close by, never stop treading them jeweled thrones, and as always, be nice to each other. Bye!
I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Hither Came Conan. Questions and comments can be directed to feedback@hithercameconan.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of Hither Came Conan, along with every other podcast under the Stephen or Else Media umbrella, early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes, or just go to hithercameconan.com to join today. Hither Came Conan is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content hosted by me, check out stephenorelse.com.
Sunny Izzy. He's later revived by a maximans boob. Boob. Oh, boy. Conan discovers that the masked man is, in fact, the real Ethereal. Ethereal, that's what I said earlier, the dumb fuck. Yeah, I know. Glenn Lord was born on November. Good God almighty. Fuck. You get this shit out the back of my throat. The synopsis used in this episode was taken from MarvelFandom.com and then altered, twisted, rewritten, and added to by me, the host of Hither Came Conan. Yeah, me, I guess. I don't know what I was trying to say there. And try that again.
I just don't think I could move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Your podcast sucks.
Enough talk.
Great Crom.